So what we saw is that if we have a black hole in four dimension, which breaks 4n supersymmetries, then the protected index that we have to analyze is the 2nth helicity trace, which I denoted by B2n. Here is the definition of the helicity trace. So it involves a trace of minus 1 to the f, but then you also insert a factor of 2h, where h is the helicity, or more specifically, it's the third component of the angular momentum in that S frame of the particle. And the reason for using this particular index is, first of all, that this index doesn't vanish automatically by clearing fermion zero modes. Okay, and for that's the reason why you have to insert a factor of 2n factors of 2h. And at the same time, it is guaranteed that this index does not receive any contribution from a state which breaks more than 4n supersymmetries. Okay, so for example, a typically non-BPA state which will break all supersymmetries, which is more than 4n, will not contribute to this index. So this is the index that we'll calculate on the microscopic side, and this is the index that is protected. And in particular, if we focus on quarter BPS black holes in n equal to 4, supersymmetric string theories, then 4n is 12, because you break 4 out of 16 supersymmetries. And the relevant index that you have to analyze is B6, okay, because 2n is 6. The question is that on the black hole side, we know how to calculate the horizon degeneracy. We don't know as yet how to calculate the horizon, how to calculate the index. And the question is, how can you use the information about the horizon degeneracy that we found using ADS to CFT1 to calculate this index? And to see how this can be done, okay, one has to first make an important observation that in general, when you try to calculate the macroscopic degeneracy or index, any calculation on the macroscopic side, when you want to do, it can get contribution from two kinds of effects. Okay? There are two kinds of contributions. One kind of contribution, which I'll call the horizon contribution, is what we have been discussing so far. So, for example, the ADS to CFT1 correspondence tells us how to calculate the degeneracy associated with the horizon. But generally, there can be another kind of contributions which can appear on the black hole side. And these contributions appear from degrees of freedom which live outside the horizon. Okay, and these degrees of freedom we'll call the hair. In general, the hair modes can be non-trivial. But there is one set of hair modes which are always present in any black holes. And these are the fermion zero modes which are associated with the broken supersymmetry generators. Okay, for any black hole which breaks some of the supersymmetry generators, we expect that there will be fermion zero modes. And one can argue quite generally that these fermion zero modes always break, always live outside the horizon. Okay, are there any questions? So the general picture that one has, okay, is the following. Okay, that a typical macroscopic configuration could involve multiple horizons, okay, which will correspond to multi-black hole solutions. It would also, in particular, it will include single black holes. But besides these degrees of freedom, okay, which are associated with the horizon, there can also be degrees of freedom living outside the horizon, which I'll call the hair degrees of freedom. Okay. So, for example, if you consider a system of two black holes, okay, then typically their dynamics is described by some quantum mechanics. The degrees of freedom associated with the quantum mechanics will be part of the hair modes. And on top of that, there will be internal degrees of freedom which count the degeneracy of each black hole separately. What tells you? See, you consider a space of solutions, right? Space of BPA solutions. So the distance may be fixed, may not be fixed, right? Sometimes the distance is fixed classically. So you consider a space of BPA solutions and then you quantize in that phase space. Right? That's, so when you quantize in that phase space, that phase space is what is contained in the hair degrees of freedom. Okay, are there any other questions? Obviously, any degree of freedom that is beyond the horizon, okay, which any extra degrees of freedom that is required to classify the macroscopic configuration, okay, will be counted as hair degree of freedom.
the letter called, say, mutually BPS, Susie.
Yes, it's not necessarily mutually BPS.
Sometimes you can consider multicenter black holes which are not BPS, okay, which basically means that you cannot move them arbitrarily, but they are rigid. Okay, so they are still, the full configuration is still BPS, but it's not that if you just pull them out at infinity, they'll be mutual BPS. Right, so you see, if they are mutually BPS, like two parallel charges, then the distance is not fixed. Right? In which case, that distance will have to be counted as a part of the Hare degree of freedom. But sometimes the distance can be fixed by the supersymmetric condition. Well, in this case, it may or may not be fixed. Depends on what kind of multicenter black holes one has. Right? If, for example, you consider a dyon whose charge is not primitive, you can just consider it two-centered, where that charge splits into two equal parallel charges. Right? In that case, the distance certainly will not be fixed. Yes, so the entropy associated with the individual black holes is not affected by the distance. Yes, in case there are BPS. Okay. But there is an extra degree of freedom which is in the center of mass, right, which you have to quantize, and you have to see whether that contributes some extra gives some extra contribution to the degenerates. Right, and that's what I'll count as part of here. Yes.
No, in string theory there are many solutions. Yeah. In fact, one special class is exactly the generalization of the Eisner-Nordstrom, where you just take parallel charges.
Right, but for black holes.
Yeah, even for black holes, if you take two black holes with whose charge vectors are parallel to each other, right, then you can consider multiple black hole solutions. Exactly multicentered Eisner-Nordstrom. Right? Extremal like Eisner-Nordstrom, we can have multiple black hole solutions. But in string theory, there are also other kinds of multiple black hole solutions where the distance between the centers are fixed.
Right? The Q1 and Q2 are not parallel charges, they are different charges. Okay? And hence, you cannot move them arbitrarily. But nevertheless, those also have to be counted in this counting. Right? Because on the macroscopic side, you should count everything. Because you fix the total asymptotic charge, and then you simply count how many states are there. Which you can then compare the microscopic results. Okay, are there any
questions? So, is there understanding on the field theory side which part of degrees of freedom get combined into sort of this thermodynamic?
Not theory. So far, no. I mean, the point is you can do the counting. Like, for example, sometimes as you move around in a moduli space,
some of the multicenter black holes disappear. Okay.
They don't turn into here. That the index actually changes. Index of degenerates actually jumps across walls of marginal stability.
So
those jumps you can see on the microscopic side. That on the microscopic side also as you move in the moduli space, you should see that the quantum mechanics has degree of freedom to jump the degenerates or the index. So near the point, if you are
near that wall of marginal stability, right, where these two black holes are going to fall apart, okay, then you can identify that the two center black holes are those which disappear, those states in the quantum mechanics, which disappear as you go across the wall of marginal stability. Right? So you can do it near those domains in the moduli space.
You change smooth without changing the degeneracy of states, where the horizon degrees of freedom go into a hair.
From the microscopic viewpoint, you don't see these two degrees of freedom separately. Okay. Yeah, so it's very hard to say which part is horizon and which part is hair.
So the gravity appears to see some.
Yes, exactly. So gravity clearly distinguishes very clearly between the horizon and the hair degrees of freedom.
Okay.
Right? But this is something that you don't see in the microscopic description at all. Okay. So you denote the degeneracy associated with here by d here.
And in general, d here can be calculated by explicitly identifying and quantizing the here modes. So you basically take a BPS black hole solution and then ask what kind of supersymmetric fluctuations it admits. Okay. Sometimes you may find that it has supersymmetric deformations, and you have to quantize the space of deformations, the space of supersymmetric deformations, and that's how you identify the here modes. Or the hair degeneracy. So if we denote the degeneracy associated with the hair modes by D here, then the total degeneracy has this natural form. Okay, it will be given by the product of the degeneracies from the horizon, and then the degeneracy of the hair. And finally, you have to sum over all possible ways of distributing the total charge between the horizon and the hair. And you also have to sum over all possible number of configurations, right? You can have one-centered black hole or a two-centered black hole, etc. Or you can even have a zero-centered black hole, which is a purely smooth configuration. Right? So you must sum over all these configurations to calculate the degeneracy on the microscopic side, on the macroscopic side, on the black hole side. Is this clear?
Are you saying there is a situation where there is no black hole but still contributes to here?
If, for example, there are smooth solutions, take a Kaluza-Klein monopole, right, which is a smooth solution of gravity, it's not a black hole, but that also contributes to the degeneracy. Right? So that, I mean, if you have to find a solution of that kind, you have to add it to the rest of the degeneracy. That I'll call here, yeah, because it's a smooth solution. Horizon. So anything that doesn't have a horizon, I'll call here.
The realization is that if you have a particular configuration of black holes, then it's up to you whether there is a hair or not. Right.
So whether there is?
Well, I'm just saying, in some sense, the hair should not. How am I sure that you are not overcounting when you count degeneracy in the hair? Maybe through the back reaction of the geometry changes the horizon of.
I consider the hair degrees of freedom as full nonlinear solutions of the field equations. Right? So in essence, you have already taken into account back reaction. Right? And even in that case, the horizon remains intact. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, the horizon geometry doesn't change depending on the hair. Except, of course, if the hair carries some charge, right, then by charge conservation, the horizon charge reduces. Okay, that changes, and that is already accounted for in this formula.
Can add a hair without changing the near horizon geometry.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And this is related to the fact that there is an infinite throat that separates the horizon from the asymptotic region. Okay, but our interest is not in calculating the total degeneracy,
but the total index, because that's what we are going to compare with the microscopic results. So let's ask, how can we compute B6 for the same configuration? And I have chosen B6 because we'll be focusing on quarterback PS black holes in N equal to 4 supersymmetric theories. So this is the formula for B6. And now, H is the total helicity, or total angular momentum, total third component of the angular momentum. So I can split this H as a sum of the horizon contribution and the hair contribution. Okay, so H horizon denotes the sum of the contribution from each of the horizons, and H here is the contribution from the hair. And similarly here, I can split into horizon and the hair degree of freedom. The next observation, which comes from supersymmetry, is that in four dimensions, supersymmetry requires that the horizon is spherically symmetric. Okay, this is a consequence of the supersymmetry algebra. This we discussed yesterday. Once you combine the SL2R isometry of ADS2 with the unbroken supersymmetries, with four unbroken supersymmetries, the total algebra includes automatically a spherical rotation in SU2 rotation, which you identify as the space-time rotation. So supersymmetry implies spherical horizon. Now, a spherical horizon, a spherically symmetric solution can either mean, for example, what it means depends on the ensemble that you are using. If, for example, you are using a grand canonical ensemble, then spherically symmetric horizon will mean that the chemical potential that is dual to angular momentum must vanish, okay, which is the angular velocity must vanish. On the other hand, if you are considering a microcanonical ensemble, then spherical symmetry requires that the angular momentum itself vanishes. Now, you have seen earlier that in ADS2, the natural interpretation is that it calculates the entropy in the microcanonical ensemble, okay, where all the charges are fixed. So, spherical symmetry on the horizon with an ADS2 factor means that H horizon must be 0. Okay, there is no angular momentum associated with the horizon degrees of freedom. And hence, in this expression for B6, we can drop the factors of H horizon and write B6 as trace of minus 1 to the 2H here and 2H here to the 6. This trace, of course, also includes the contribution from the horizon and the hair degrees of freedom. This is the full trace. But now we can split this trace into the trace over the horizon modes and the trace over the hair modes. And because the horizon mode, there is no dependence on the horizon angular momentum in this, inside the trace, the trace over the horizon mode simply gives you the degeneracy associated with the horizon, okay, which is here. And then the trace over the hair modes gives you back the B6 for the hair. So this is then the final formula for B6 of the macroscopic of B6 on the macroscopic side. And the key point is ADS2 CFT1 correspondence told us how to calculate D horizon in terms of partition function on ADS2. And what we see here is that the index on the macroscopic side also involves the same quantity D horizon. Okay, and hence we can make use of the D horizon to calculate the index on the macroscopic side. We still have to calculate this, B6, for the hair, but this is a reasonably straightforward job once you have identified the hair modes. Right? You just look at a black hole solution or a multi-black hole solution, look at these possible supersymmetric deformations, and simply quantize that space and calculate the index B6 by taking this trace. Are there any questions? So this is the reason why we can relate an index calculated on the microscopic side to a degeneracy calculated on the macroscopic side. Now things simplify in n equal to 4 supersymmetric string theories. Because first of all, one finds that the contribution from multicentered black holes is exponentially suppressed. Okay, they are still present, and in fact, they do play a crucial role in matching the microscopic and the microscopic sides. Okay, but I'll not discuss that here. But any contribution from multicentered black holes, one can show is exponentially suppressed. So if you are trying to analyze the leading asymptotic expansion, okay, say expansion in inverse powers of charges to any order, then we can simply forget about multicentered black hole configurations. Furthermore, if we take single-centered black holes, then one finds that often the only hair modes are the fermion zero modes. Okay, in appropriate duality frame, you can arrange that the only hair modes are fermion zero modes. Okay, in fact, in particular, if you choose a duality frame in which all the charges of the black hole comes from brains, D brains, okay, then one can argue that they are non-trivial hair modes. In this case, the calculation of the B6 is trivial. Okay, you just quantize the fermion zero modes, the 12 fermion zero modes, and calculate B6 associated with that. And in the normalization that you have chosen, one can show that B6 here is minus 1. And so this gives a relation, specific relation between B6 and D horizon. Okay. Namely, on the macroscopic side, B6 is given by minus D horizon. Okay, this minus sign comes because of this minus 1 in B6 here. And this, in turn, makes a very specific prediction about the sign of B6. Even without calculating this D horizon, we know that D horizon is, of course, positive because it calculates the degeneracy associated with the horizon. And hence, B6 must be negative. Okay, this is a prediction for the sign of the index from the macroscopic side.
Isn't there still one center of mass mode for the Even if it's a single center?
Yes. So that center of mass mode, as I said, center,
when you quantize the center of mass mode, you get momentum eigenstates. Right? So you can look at the zero momentum center. Right? So similarly on the microscopic side, also there will be a momentum, similar center of mass mode. And you quantize it and put it in a zero momentum eigenstate. Yeah, so that doesn't give any extra contribution to the degeneracy. So it is true that that is also part of the hair mode in this definition. But if that's the quantization of that mode is trivial.
Got any other questions? Okay. Now let me generalize it slightly to two study
index that we described yesterday. So yesterday we described how to calculate trace horizon of G, and we made a very specific prediction from the macroscopic side, namely that trace horizon of G should grow as 1 over nth power of the black hole the degeneracy, okay, where G is a Zn generator. But we can now ask what particular index we should calculate, we should focus on, okay, which does not change as you go from the weak coupling to strong coupling, so that you can compare the results on the microscopic and the macroscopic side. And the generalization of the B6 for a twisted index is this. So imagine that you have a Zn symmetry which is generated by G, and imagine that G commutes with all the supersymmetries. Okay, that's the way you have chosen G. Then we introduce this index B6 G, okay, by inserting this extra factor of G in that case. And this we can again argue that this is protected, okay, because this receives contribution only from BPS states. Okay, a generic non-BPS state will give zero contribution to this index. We can then follow the same logic as in the case of P6 by splitting the trace over the hair and the horizon modes. And one can argue that on the black hole side, P6 will be given by minus trace horizon of G. And since trace horizon of G was predicted on the macroscopic side to go as exponential 1 over n times the world entropy, that is the same prediction for B6G. So what we will do next is to try to verify all these predictions, the general predictions as well as the more specific terms in the expression for the index on the microscopic and the macroscopic side.
Any questions?
So you, in the end, you won't claim that the degeneracies actually match, but only that this index matches?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Because you can calculate the degeneracy on the microscopic side, but there's no theorem which tells us that will remain the same as those switch on the car. But on the black hole side, the degeneracy is the index. Okay, that's what this form, that's what this is showing. Yeah, so what we're matching is actual degeneracy on the black hole side, but it's not the degeneracy on the microscopic side. Any other questions?
So if I'm a little confused, so does that mean the degeneracies should not match?
In general, there is no reason why the degeneracy should match, because there can be BPS states on the microscopic side, which as you turn on the coupling becomes non-BPS. See, protection doesn't tell us that each BPS state individual should remain BPS as you change the coupling.
No, but I mean, if you could compute the total degeneracy somehow.
Yeah, if you could calculate the degeneracy at strong coupling, where the gravity, the system really forms a black hole, then they should match. It's just that we don't know how to calculate the degeneracy at strong coupling. Right? Degeneracy as well as the index is calculated at weak coupling on the microscopic side.
So I forgot. So you say the G horizon, okay. When you have included the data of Zn symmetry, okay, so this trace is given by the exponential 1 over n times.
S1. Yes.
Can you remember what the formula was for this S?
For the horizon. Okay. The general formula that we derived was that these are trace horizon of key. If G is a Zn generator,
yes,
goes as exponential 1 over n,
yes,
times 1 n,
yes,
plus dimensions. And in a large charge limit, this is the first term here is the biggest. Right? So this is just the area over 4 g, but divided by n.
Yeah, so what kind of expression from the microscopic calculation to anticipate?
Yes, I'll describe it.
Okay.
When I describe the microscopic calculation, you will see what one gets.
Okay.
Okay, so now
let me describe the result for the microstate counting. Okay, I'll not describe the method, or I'll not describe the procedure because that's a long one. Okay. But the basic philosophy is simple, so I'll try to explain how it is done. Okay. So the theory that we'll be considering, that the class of theories that we'll be considering, are n equal to 4 supersymmetric string theories. And the simplest example of an n equal to 4 supersymmetric string theory is heterotic string theory compactified on a 6-dimensional torus. Okay, which is also dual to type 2 string theory compactified on K3 times a 2-dimensional torus. Okay, and that is exploited quite intensively in this counting analysis. So this theory is known to have 28 U1 gauge fields at a generic point in the moduli space. It has 28 U1 gauge fields. And these 28 U1 gauge fields comes from 16 U1 gauge fields in the original 10-dimensional theory, 6 from the metric, and 6 from the antisymmetric tensor theory. So because of this, a generic charge state in this theory will be characterized by a 28-dimensional electric charge vector, which I'll denote by Q, and 28-dimensional magnetic charge vector, which I'll denote by P. Okay, so you need altogether 56 charges to characterize a state. And the degeneracy or the index in general will depend on all the 56 charges. But this theory has a duality symmetry. Okay, in particular, it has a T-duality symmetry, O622Z. And under this T-duality symmetry, the Q and P transformers vectors. Okay, so Q and P are 28-dimensional vectors, each 28-dimensional vectors, and they transform in the vector representation of O622. Okay, so in other words, O622 represented this as a 28 by 28 matrix, and these transform as vectors of that matrix. So because of the T-duality invariance, okay, we can define T-duality invariance instead of looking at every component of the charge separately. We can define T-duality invariant bilinears in the charges, and we'll denote these bilinears by Q square, P square, and Q dot P. The one thing to note is that these, even though I have denoted this by Q square, P square, and Q dot P, these are not positive definite, right? Because the metric that one has to use to calculate this is the metric O622 metric. Now, starting from this theory, one can construct a more general class of n equal to 4 supersymmetric string theories. And those are obtained simply by taking orbifolds, appropriate orbifolds of heterotic string theory on T6. And these class of models, which preserve n equal to 4 supersymmetry, are known as CHL models. And one of the features of these theories is that typically they have reduced rank. Instead of having 28 U1 gauge fields, they typically have some R plus 6 U1 gauge fields for some number R. And the value of R depends on which specific or before you have taken of the original theory. 6 is always common because the 6 U1 gauge fields are in fact part of the gravity multiplet, so they always have to be there. N equal to 4 supersymmetric, n equal to 4 supergravity must have 6 U1 gauge fields as part of the gravity multiplet. So in these theories, Q and P will be R plus 6 dimensional vectors, and we can similarly define bilinears, OR6 invariant bilinears, Q square, P square, and Q dot. And it turns out that in each of these theories, this index, B6, as a function of the two charges, can be calculated exactly for a wide class of charge vectors. Okay, it has not been done for every possible charge vectors QP, but for a wide class of charge vectors, one can actually calculate explicitly what this index is.
So what I'll do
now is to just tell you how it is done, okay, and then try to explain how the results are read. Are there any questions?
Do you have
the open code of K3? Yes. So you take K3 times K2, right? And you take a shift along K2 and one of the circles of K2 and take an orbit folder and corresponding Zn action on K3. Right? And all you have to make sure that
whatever action on K3 you have commutes with all the supersymmetries. That it must preserve the 2-0 form of K3. So you have an orbital description both on the heterotic and the typos. Okay, so how is the computation done? The computation is actually done in a dual frame. So one uses the dual description as type 2B string field on K3 times T2 and its various orbital folds. Okay, the original heterotic string theory on T6 is type 2B on K3 times T2 and the CHL models are orbital folds of this. So what one does is that in each of these theories, one computes this index for a specific class of configurations, okay, which involve rotating D1, D5 system, okay, D1, D5 with momentum in a Kaluza-Klein and monopole background. And it turns out that this class of charges is sufficiently wide, okay, so that you can actually get the result for a finite subset of all the charge vectors in the theory by using duality symmetry. So one starts with a system like this, take a D1, D5 system in the Kaluza-Klein monopole background, and then one starts identifying its degrees of freedom, right? What kind of excitations it has. And because you are calculating the index, we can choose to calculate the index in the weak coupling limit. And in the weak coupling limit, essentially the degrees of freedom all become non-interacting. Okay, they basically become free fields or free quantum mechanics. So the dynamics is essentially given by that of a system of decoupled harmonic oscillators. And because they are just a set of decoupled harmonic oscillators, we can actually compute V6 exactly. Okay. So essentially one calculates the contribution to V6 from each harmonic oscillator and put the results together. So the initial result that one gets from here is typically a function of the total momentum that you have chosen, the total number of D1 brains and D5 brains you have chosen, and so on. But then by using T-duality symmetry, we re-express the result in terms of these T-duality invariant combinations of the charges. So this essentially is the way the calculation takes place. Okay?
Take it into account. Yes,
the Kaluza-Klein monopole represents this as a Taubner space. Okay? That's a fixed background, but that has its own excitations. Right? A Taubner space, for example, has a harmonic form, right? And using that normalizable harmonic form, you can create modes which are supersymmetric. Right? And you just have to quantize all those modes as part of these oscillators. So those become part of the oscillators.
You have any other questions? In each of these cases,
we can calculate the result and express this as a Fourier expansion coefficients of some known functions. So typically, the V6 is written as a triple Fourier integral. Okay, this is just a phase factor, which is important, of course, but which you can forget for now. It's given as a phase factor times a triple Fourier integral of a function which I'll denote by Z. Okay, so rho, sigma, and V are the chemical potentials which are conjugate to Q square, and Q dot P. Okay, and so you take this Fourier integral. And each of these examples, Z is known, okay, because we calculate it using harmonic oscillators. But what's more important, okay, and what is a somewhat surprising result, is that in each of these examples, it turns out that this Z transforms as a modular form of certain weights under subgroups of SP2Z. Okay, so it has some certain modular properties, okay, which is totally unexpected. This modular property does not follow from any of the duality symmetries of the string theory. You do the calculation, and at the end, after you have put the contribution from all the harmonic oscillators, you find that this Z happens to have this additional symmetries. Is this
clear? Yeah. Are there any questions? Yes.
What are
rho and sigma? These are the integration variables. Physically, you can, okay. The point is, imagine that you have a set of decoupled harmonic oscillators. Okay. And you want to calculate the total V6 or total degeneracy for that system. Now, in statistical mechanics, whenever you have a set of decoupled statistical systems, it's much easier to calculate the partition function rather than the degeneracy individual. Right? Because for calculating degeneracy, you have to put a constraint, you have a constraint sum. So you introduce the corresponding chemical potential, calculate the result, partition function, and then you make a Fourier transform. So this rho sigma and V are appropriate chemical potentials which are dual to these various charges. Right? For example, rho, if you go back to the previous slide, one of these variables is dual to the total momentum that the system carries. Another variable is dual to the total d-orbital number that the system carries. Okay, and the third one is dual to some angular momentum that the system carries. That's the way they can get the form. Okay, are there any other questions?
Do you know the range of integration?
Yes, these are from 0 to 1. This is a periodic function. So, rho, sigma, and p are integrated from 0 to 1. But it turns out that in order for this integral to be well-defined, you have to actually do an integration, not along the real axis, but at some fixed imaginary value of rho, sigma, and p, and then they will integrate. Right? Because on the real axis, this function has poles. And this prescription also automatically follows. So, for example, the rho, if you have a complex rho plane, imaginary rho. We fix some fixed imaginary rho and then integrate from 0 to 1. Okay, similarly sigma.
So, does the value of the integral depends on the contour you choose?
Yes, it does, but very mildly. Okay, and that's an important point which I will not discuss here. The value of the integral does depend on the contour you choose. But what contour you choose is uniquely fixed by specifying which point in the moduli specify. That's it's not an arbitrary information. So as I said, this theory has a moduli space, that you can vary the asymptotic values of the scalar fields at infinity. Once you fix the values of the scalar fields, the choice of the contour is fixed. And as you vary the asymptotic moduli, what can happen sometimes is so the contours keep changing. And in general, because by Gauss's theorem, the result of the integral shouldn't change.
Okay. Unless you cross a pole. Okay. So, on certain subspaces of the moduli space, the contour hits a pole. And the result changes. But that change you can interpret precisely as the disappearance of a two-centered black hole. Okay, that as you vary, as you move in the moduli space, now if you go to the black hole picture, as you move in this moduli space, the distance between the two centers of the black hole keeps changing. And precisely on these subspaces where this contour hits a pole, these two-centered black holes become infinitely separated. And beyond that, it simply disappears. Okay, so there is a very precise connection between the changes in this integral as you move in the moduli space to disappearance of two-centered black holes on the macroscopic side.
So,
relates to
the wall crossing?
Yes, it is all related to wall crossing. Exactly. So, wall crossing, which is this phenomenon that as you cross certain walls in the moduli space, a two-centered black hole or a multi-centered black hole, which are existing on one side of the wall, may disappear, and the image of that in the microscopic side Okay. Is that the result depends on the choice of contour. Okay, mildly, in the sense that under continuous deformation it doesn't change, but it can have discrete jumps whenever the contour crosses the pole. And that jump is precisely equal to the degeneration of the two centered black hole which disappears.
And that's always under the condition of the fixed source of charges.
Yes, exactly.
It disappears, the charge still remains in the hair, so the total charge doesn't change. I mean, the ones that disappear.
So, these escapes are not there. When you say it disappears, see, the point you still have single centered black hole, which always exists.
Right.
This two centered black hole, this solution exists on one side of the wall.
Right.
It doesn't exist on the other side of the wall.
Right.
Right? Which means that actual index jumps, because the index was getting a contribution from this configuration earlier.
Sure.
And it simply doesn't get a contribution afterwards.
I understand that, but I thought we are computing the index. Keeping the sort of in a microcanonical ensemble when we keep the charges fixed. That's important. So the fact that you have this wall crossing phenomena and some of the states disappear, the total charge of the system before the crossing and after.
Okay. The point is, this is not a dynamical process that you are considering here. Right? See, like any point in a modular space, we have a Hilbert space.
Right.
And there is certain dimension of the Hilbert space. When I say that this start just disappeared, right, that means that the dimension of the Hilbert space jumps. That here you have so many states.
Okay?
As you go, suppose this is the wall of modular assembly. Okay, as you cross the wall and as you come to this point, is that the dimension of the Hilbert space changes. Right? You're always counting Hilbert space at a fixed charge. So these one, so when I say these are these disappear, that means the whole state disappears. Because these are created by themselves. It's not that these were superimposed on the single centered
one. Right. We have a contribution from single centered black hole plus two centered black hole configuration. Right. In one region of the modulized space, both contribute. In the other region of the modulized space, only this one contributes. Is that point clear? So it's not a dynamical process that this object disappears. Right, it disappears as a function of the moduli, which you are tuning externally, right? And the state simply stops existing beyond that point. Okay, are there any other questions?
Okay, now let me explain what
means by saying that Z is known. So the way Z is known is as follows. Okay, so Z is given as a product. These coefficients are known. Okay, A, B, C, these are the three constants, these are known. And then you have an infinite product, okay, over integral. These coefficients, C, which is a function of Mn and P, these are also known coefficients, known functions of Mn and P. Okay, so this is what you calculate. Okay. And you can also see how this comes about. So essentially, each harmonic oscillator gives you one factor of this. If it's a bosonic harmonic oscillator, it gives you with a minus sign. If it's a fermionic harmonic oscillator, it gives you with a plus sign. So what you do is that you calculate for each MNP how many bosonic oscillators are there, how many fermionic oscillators are there, calculate the difference, and that's this number C. And then you take a product. Okay, that's how this formula comes about. And these coefficients are just the effect of the zero-point energy or zero-point charge of those harmonic oscillators. Okay, again, for each harmonic oscillator, you have to calculate the zero-point values and add them up, and that's these numbers. And because these numbers are known, we can see that we can expand it out, okay, as a power series expansion in this exponent, and calculate the coefficient of any power of e to the 2 pi I rho into any power of e to the 2 pi I sigma and any power of e to the 2 pi I phi. And those coefficients are precisely the numbers. They are the index P6. And because P6 is the Fourier coefficients of this expansion of Z. So it's a simple job to write a computer program, okay, which will tell you how to calculate B6. So given any pair of charges, Q and P, you can write a simple computer program which will tell you what is the value of B6. Okay, you just have to expand this function out and pick up the appropriate Fourier coefficient in this expansion. identical.
Can I ask a very naive question? So is there something special that happens when the two black holes come very close together?
See, the multi-centered black holes can never come very close to each other. Right? But as you move in a modularized space, there's always a finite separation between the two centered black holes. It is in any part of four theory. So you don't have that situation. Okay. Now, what is important for us
is not that you can explicitly calculate the numbers for given any charges QP, but that you should be able to get the result, you should be able to expand this result for B6 for large charges. Okay? Because that's what we can compare to the black hole side, because black hole the expansion that you get from the black hole side always starts in a leading order as the maximum power of charge, and then you get corrections. So you should be able to calculate corrections to B6 for large charges. And fortunately, this can be done because of this specific modular properties of the partition function that I mentioned. Okay, making use of the modular properties, which, as I said, is an accident. Okay, it didn't have to be there, but it is there. And making use of the modular property, one can actually calculate systematically the large charge expansion of log B6. First of all, one finds that in each case that has been studied for each of the CHL models, B6 is negative. Okay, so and this is consistent with the macroscopic prediction that we said, because B6 was related to minus D horizon and D horizon was positive. So B6 was negative from the macroscopic side, and that is indeed true from the microscopic side as well. So here is the result for B6. This one can be identified as a lead-in Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. If you calculate the corresponding result on the black hole side, okay, the Bekenstein-Hawking result is this, okay, which is also the world entropy in this case, because at a free level, you can show the Bekenstein-Hawking result is exact. Then there is a correction of order Q to the 0. These corrections of order Q to the 0 are quite complicated. Okay, it involves a complicated function of the ratios of the charges. And this function is different for different CHL models. So you see that this is universal. Okay, for all n equal to 4 supersymmetric string theories, the leading term is the same, okay, which is just as well, because the leading term is controlled by the supergravity approximation to the theory, and the supergravity approximation doesn't really know very much about the details of the theory, okay, which CHL model you are considering. The leading term is the same, but the first subleading correction to the microscopic result for B6 does depend non-trivially on the theory that you are considering. Okay, so this function, for example, which is given here, okay, this is a result for heterotic string theory on P6. Okay, and you can see even at this case, even in this case, it involves this complicated Dirac and eta functions. Okay, and you have to substitute the values of tau 1 and tau 2, okay, which are here, to get the first correction to the entropy. And in principle, you can calculate this expansion to any order that you like. Okay, again, that is a very systematic procedure, and you can use it. It has been calculated to this order, okay, but it can be calculated to any order that you like. Are there any questions?
Just to be equally big.
Basically, if you think of it as a high dimensional geometry, right, some components of the curvature becomes large. Right? So, when all the charges are equally big, that's the simplest case, when the curvature remains small everywhere.
And how does the string coupling go in terms of the charges?
In this case, okay, the string coupling, it depends on which duality frame you use. Right? In one duality frame, the string coupling is a water one. But if you use a type 2B frame, you can make the string coupling small, because there are some flat directions. And utilizing those flat directions, you can keep the string coupling small. Okay. So can you explain the results from the black hole side?
So if we look at a black hole which carries the same charges as the microscopic system, we can calculate the world entropy, or in this case it's the same as Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And as I've already mentioned, it's exactly what you got from the microscopic side. So this reproduces the leading result in log mod B6. Okay, so this is the second test. We have already seen the sign of B6 works out correctly. Now you can ask, what about the first set of corrections? Now, quite generally, one can show that, okay, it of course depends on which duality frame you are using, but if you use a duality frame in which you are using type 2B duality frame, and if all the charges that you have taken are transformed into D-brain charges by appropriate duality map, okay, and then there is a very precise correspondence you can make as to which order in charge will appear at which loop. Okay. So one can show, for example, that anything that is quadratic in the charges must appear at tree level. Anything that is of order q to the 0 must appear at one loop. Okay. Order 1 over q square corrections must appear at two loops, and so on. Okay. So next order correction, okay, which is this one, okay, this is of order q to the 0. So if this has to be reproduced on the type 2 side, it better come at one loop. Okay. Otherwise, you don't get this kind of q to the 0 dependence. Okay. And indeed, one finds that by integrating out the massive modes, the result of the integrating on the massive modes, we have already seen earlier that you can use, of course, the ADS to CF2 correspondence, but you can just also use a one-pair action that one gets by integrating out massive modes, because one-pair action that you get from here is local. Okay, so you can calculate the one-pair action by integrating out the massive modes, and you get a local one-loop correction term. And using that one-loop correction term, we can use Wald's formula to calculate the correction to the entropy. And what one finds is that is an answer which is exactly, okay, it's exactly the same function that appeared in the previous slide. So for each of the CHL models, including the heterotic on T6, this function F that appeared on the microscopic side was the result of a microscopic calculation. Okay, and it involved this complicated Dedekind and eta function even in the simple case of heterotic on T6. On the macroscopic side, on the black hole side, we get exactly the same correction, but now this function is the result of a one-loop calculation involving massive modes. Okay, you get this function by integrating out the massive string states at one loop. And nevertheless, one finds that it's exactly the same function that appears on both sides, okay, confirming that indeed the black hole entropy is reproduced by the microscopic results to this order. Okay, you can use Gauss-Bonnet, but more generally, you can use the supersymmetric version of curvature squared term, right? And they give the same result.
The fact that you're associating this with integrating out massive modes, is it by a direct calculation, or is it just by supersymmetrizing the Gauss-Bonnet?
By supersymmetrizing the Gauss-Bonnet, right? One gets the R squared term by integrating a massive mode. So one also knows the string theory is supersymmetric, so you just supersymmetrize the R squared term.
But there's some field recognition involved.
Yeah, but those will, correct things to higher order.
Yeah.
Right? They may give corrections of order 1 over 2 square, so you keep track of the field recognitions at this, that order. But at this order, we should check this. Okay, now we also discussed logarithmic corrections, which come from integrating on the massless modes. So one can ask, what about logarithmic corrections? Okay, does this formula have logarithmic corrections? Now, we look at the microscopic result, okay, and that clearly doesn't have any log Q correction. You can see from here, right? This is a perfectly good function of the ratios of the charges. It doesn't have any log Q. So the microscopic result suggests that the logarithmic corrections must be absent in all n equal to 4 supersymmetric string theories. But I should also emphasize that this is not true in general for any supersymmetric theory, because n equal to 8 supersymmetric string theories, if you look at the similar microscopic formula for the entropy, for the index, it does have logarithmic correction. Okay, so this is a special feature of n equal to 4 supersymmetric theories. So given this, we can ask, can we verify this by evaluating the one-loop contribution to ZADS2 due to massless particles? Okay, that's the standard procedure that one has to use. And as I discussed yesterday, that if you have had a massless scalar, for example, okay, it would give a logarithmic correction with a very specific coefficient. So one can go ahead and try to calculate the contribution due to the massless particles. Okay.
Now, it turns out that this calculation is technically complicated, okay, because essentially what it involves is to expand n equal to supergravity action around the black hole background and calculate the one-loop determinant. So far what has been done, okay, is to do this calculation involving the matter multiplet fields. Fortunately, it turns out that when you expand the supergravity action around the black hole background, the matter and the gravity multiplet fields don't mix. And what has been checked so far is that the matter multiplet fields do not give any logarithmic correction to the partition function. Okay, so all the logarithmic corrections cancel from the matter multiplet fields.
So, it's just you, in Z ADS2, right, you have to integrate over the ADS2 times K. Right? So, you take string theory on this background and you integrate over that background.
Oh.
One loop, you calculate the one loop determinant in that background. Because anything that gets outside the horizon, of course, is separately taken into account by the KR loops. Now, the fact that this cancel
does not, of course, necessarily prove that the logarithmic corrections are absent, because you also have to deal with the gravity multiplet fields. Okay. But it does satisfy one consistency check. And that is that if we had found that the matter multiplet fields do a non-vanishing contribution, it would be a manifest contradiction with what you see on the microscopic side. One can ask, would it have been possible that maybe matter multiplet give a non-vanishing contribution and the gravity multiplet contribution cancels it? Right? Why isn't that possible? The reason that it is not possible is because it can happen for one theory, but it cannot happen for every CHL model, okay? Because the different CHL models have same gravity multiplet, so the gravity sector is universal, but the matter multiplet sector, how many matter multiplets you have, is different in different CHL models. So it is certainly a necessary condition, okay, for connection with the microscopic results, that each matter multiplet must give vanishing logarithmic correction. It still remains to check that the contribution to the gravity multiplet also vanishes. Okay? That would prove that indeed the one loop result is completely consistent, both including massive and massless mode contribution. The one loop result matches onto the black hole, onto the microscopic result. Yes?
You're saying there are logarithmic corrections there.
On the microscopic side, certainly there are logarithmic corrections.
On the macroscopic side, can you do similar analysis and show that presumably they also attributed only to matter multiplets?
See, n equal to 8, of course, doesn't have any
specific matter multiplet. That everything is in the gravity multiplet.
N equal to 4 language, yes.
See, if you write in the n equal to 4 language, then clearly the matter multiplet contribution vanishes. So how does n equal to 4 and n equal to 8 differ? I think it's essentially because of the gravity no multiplet. That the n equal to 8 has 4 extra gravity nodes, and you can think of them as some n equal to 4 multiplet. So those must contribute. And that's what this analysis indicates.
Are there any other questions?
So you identify the 1 over Q expansion with the G-string expansion?
Yes, in the specific duality term, you should think of this as a range intact to me.
In that frame, what about the alpha prime expansion?
See, the point is, you can show the alpha prime expansion and G-string expansion gets coupled. Okay, that because of the some certain flat directions, okay, it's related to the fact that, the string coupling expansion is controlled by hyper and again, depending on what duality frame you are using. Mm-hmm. Right? And there is some decoupling theorem that you can use. Okay, so essentially what happens is that the two derivative terms contribute only at the tree level. At tree level, only two derivative terms contribute. At one loop, you can argue that only four derivative terms will contribute. Okay? At two loop, the six derivative terms will contribute, and so on. So, that's the alpha prime expansion and the G-string expansion gets coupled. And at one loop, you can argue that you cannot get any correction from tree level hard derivative terms in this way. Any other questions? Okay, so let me say a few words about the Zn twisted index.
So how do you find the Zn symmetry? Okay, we discussed this earlier. So as you move in the moduli space of CHL models, on spatial subspaces of the parameter space, we find extra Zn symmetries. Okay, the theory develops extra Zn symmetries. What possible n you can get depends on what specific CHL model you are considering. So, for example, if you take heterotic on T6, we can have the possible values of n are 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, if you take a more general CHL model, then there are less number of allowed values of n. Okay, but for every CHL model, as you move in the moduli space, you find that on certain subspaces, you can get extra Zn discrete symmetry. So you can work on the spatial subspaces, and we can define the twisted index. Okay, BG6 that I introduced earlier, we calculate the same helicity trace, but with G inserted into the trace. And we can again go back to the type 2B frame. Okay, think of this as a weakly coupled set of oscillators. Okay, so you just have a set of decoupled harmonic oscillators. And you are calculating the same trace, trace over the same set of states, except that now you have to put a weight factor of G. Okay, this can be done. And again, the result is known, can be calculated exactly. And one can calculate this twisted index, and one finds a very similar Fourier expansion for the twisted index. Okay, of course, with a different function Zg. Okay, Zg has exactly again the same product form, but the difference being that in the product, you also have a factors of G inside. Okay, so different oscillators carry different G quantum number, and that has to be taken into account in calculating Zg. So the important question is, how does this index behave for large charges? Okay, when Q square and P square and Q dot P are large. And again, because this Zg happens to have certain modular symmetries, which is accidental, we can actually systematically calculate how it behaves for large charges. And what one finds is that for large charges, this goes as exponential 1 over n times the entropy. Okay, this was the entropy factor, and this goes as 1 over n, exponential 1 over n times the entropy. Now, from a microscopic viewpoint, okay, I should emphasize that there is no, I mean, deeper understanding of why it goes as this. Okay, you just do the calculation, and at the end of the calculation, you find that you get an expression of this type, okay, which, as I emphasized yesterday, okay, is somewhat surprising and requires highly delicate cancellation between the different contributions or different states. Because what you are doing is that you are calculating the average of G, okay, which on each state G takes the value of order 1. You are calculating its average over a large number of states. And what you find is an answer, the average is much, much less than the number of states. Okay, so there is a very delicate cancellation between the contribution from the different states to give you an answer like this. But this is precisely what we had predicted from the macroscopic analysis. Okay, from the macroscopic analysis, we saw that the saddle point that contributes to BG6, okay, is not the leading saddle point, not the leading ADS2 times S2 geometry, but an orbifold of this, and that precisely led to this prediction. So you see that even for the twisted index, we have exact agreement between the macroscopic and the microscopic size. Any questions?
Okay, so let me then just conclude with the last slide.
So all of these results that I described on the microscopic side, you can interpret as the experimental verification of the theory of extremal black holes based on Wald's formula and ADS2 CFT1 correspondence. Okay, Wald's formula and ADS2 CFT1 correspondence gives a very specific prediction of what the index should be, and that's what we verify by doing a microscopic calculation. Now, the eventual hope is to reproduce the complete asymptotic expansion of the microscopic results. So, this, as I said, is known. You can calculate, you can carry out its expansion to any order that you like. In principle, there is an accuracy. I mean, you know what to compare this with. Okay, it involves a partition function at ADS2, which requires doing a path integral of the fields over ADS2. So you know what you should compare it with, but of course it's not easy to calculate a string path integral over a complicated background space-time. But we hope that perhaps it is not an impossible task that that one can have an exact matching between the microscopic and the macroscopic side. And the reason that it might be possible, okay, is because of supersymmetry, okay, that there are many examples, okay, which are closely related to the one that we have discussed here, okay, where localization of the path integral to a finite dimensional subspace is possible using supersymmetry. Okay, so even though we start with an infinite dimensional integral over the full configuration space, using supersymmetry we can try to localize it to a finite dimensional integral. And if we can do that, then we can perhaps directly compare with the integral form of B6 that we arrived at on the microscopic side. So that's the hope. And in that process, okay, we hope that we'll learn not only about black holes, but also about string theory, because as of now, we really don't have much idea as to how to carry out path integral over string fields in a complicated background geometry. Okay, all we have is polyhedral path integral. Okay, and perhaps by trying to match the microscopic and the macroscopic results, okay, we'll know the rules for carrying out path integral over string fields. Okay, so I think I'll stop.
More question. Can you say something more about this reduction to a finite dimensional path integral?
Yeah, okay. The basic idea is the following. Now imagine that you are integrating over some configuration space. And suppose you make a point in the configuration space. Now because of supersymmetry, you can slice the configuration space into the orbits of the supersymmetry algebra and the transverse orbits. Now let's imagine that you go on an orbit of the supersymmetry algebra, or an alternate formula generator of the supersymmetry algebra. Okay, so suppose Q is a formula generator. Then starting from this, the orbit of Q will be a glass dimension. And because supersymmetry is symmetric, the integral doesn't depend on the glass dimension. So you expect that in that case, this glass one integral will get the path integral direction. Right? Because the integral over a single glass one variable leads to zero. So this basically says, okay, this is a very high picture, but this roughly says that you can localize the path integral over fixed point of the supersymmetry algebra. Right? Because it's only if there is no orbit, if it's a fixed point of the supersymmetry algebra, that means the configuration is supersymmetry invariant, then that can work. So the idea is that you start with the whole configuration space of the string fields, and then you look for fixed point of the supersymmetry algebra, and try to reduce the path integral over the set of fixed points, right, over the supersymmetry invariant configurations. And that often happens to be finite dimensional space. That is in many Gauss theories. In any code for Gauss theories, for example, people have calculated Wilson loop expectation model precisely using this thing. Yeah. You start with infinite dimensional integral over the configuration space, but then using supersymmetry, you can actually reduce it to finite dimensional. And so the idea is that if we can do something similar on the microscopic side, on the macroscopic side, as in the path integral over ADS2, then you will be able to directly arrive at the integral form of B6 that I gave on the microscopic side. And on the microscopic side, you have three integrals. And one of the integrals can be done by using Gauss's theorem. So it really is two integrals, and integrals over two dimensional space. And it may be that from the macroscopic side, one can directly arrive at that integral over two dimensional space.
So if there are no more questions, let's thank Ashok for a nice set of lectures.